Welcome to Episode 3 of RISE, an Eastern Standard series about the extreme flash flood of July 28, 2022, that claimed 44 lives, swept away homes, and blindsided staff at the National Weather Service station in Jackson.
Did we forecast it being that extreme? No.
Weather Service meteorologist Pete Gagarian.
You know, one thing that we'll do is when we have an event, especially of this magnitude, we'll kind of go back, look at, okay, was there any indicators? Did we miss something, you know? And from a model perspective, like, was there really any model predicting this kind of an event? And in this day and age, it's confidence. You know, we in the past, we're kind of more focused on these sort of deterministic one model solution forecast, where it's like, okay, you have this model, it's giving you one solution. We're in an era now where we have many model solutions, an ensemble of solutions. So statistically, you're more likely to have a better verifying forecast with more solutions, potential solutions. So even from an ensemble perspective, though, there was very little confidence that this event was going to be that extreme.
And just how extreme quickly became all too evident, catching many Eastern Kentuckians off guard. Mandy Scheffel owns the Red Spotted Newt bookstore in Hazard.
Typically, we know that a storm's coming. We know that storm's capable of producing heavy rainfall. We have time to prepare. We have predictors. We know at what level the river's going to crest. And so we're prepared oftentimes for this type of flooding. And this time it came in the middle of the night. There was little warning, especially for people in remote areas where there is no cell phone service. You know, they had no warning. They had no way of knowing what was about to happen.
Eastern Kentuckians have been through this before and have been pushing through what this one threw at them and took from them, trying to recover, although for many the process has been slow going, and some saying it's going to take years. The storm and flash flood of July 22, it seems, was unlike anything in the past. State Emergency Management Director Jeremy Slinker.
I've traveled around and talked to different folks that went through this horrific event. The stories they tell is almost like something you would watch on a movie of how horrifying or how traumatic of the events transpired and how they were able to escape with their lives. And then, of course, we know, you know, there's many that didn't. that we continually grieve for. So that's why I know this time it's different.
Different enough to actually consider what had been out of the question, abandoning the hollers for higher ground if made available and affordable. Was this a freak storm, or was it the latest in a trend of more frequent extreme weather events? I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Our focus this week, Earth's climate and its calling card, extreme weather.
What we've learned over the past 20 years is that oftentimes extreme events are the face of climate change. People might not notice in their day-to-day lives a small average change in global average temperature, but those small changes in global average temperature have huge impacts on the tails of the distribution and the frequency and intensity of these extreme events.
Stephanie Herring with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You'll hear more from Stephanie later in the hour. Climate change. Is there a connection with the extreme weather being experienced from coastal Florida to Buffalo, New York, and from California to southeastern Kentucky, and the heavy rainstorm that stalled overhead last July, quickly swelling ankle-deep creeks to depths of 30 feet? This episode of RISE is a search for some understanding of what happened in the sky above and on the ground below in 13 Kentucky counties on the night of July 27th and well into the morning of the 28th. What is going on with the weather?
The biggest thing that I remember is the roller coaster of a summer that we had leading up to this.
Assistant State Climatologist Megan Chargorodsky takes us back to the summer of 22.
We had very high temperatures and heat indexes. We had extreme drought, and then we moved into the latter part of the summer, and the drought was still persistent, But we did see this event that formulated over eastern Kentucky, and it created the conditions that led to this really extreme precipitation.
And by that you mean the ground was hardened by the drought, is that right?
Yes.
Not a sponge like it might normally be.
Yeah, whenever you have a drought-type condition, the ground is really hard, and it almost acts as an impermeable surface. So as that rain is falling, it is hitting what essentially is that impermeable surface that doesn't soak up the rain as well as something that is already slightly wet.
What are some important distinctive characteristics of the storm system that caused this flooding?
The really unique part of this storm system was the fact that we had such a warm atmosphere and we had a lot of moisture in that atmosphere. And so combining that alongside of the storm system that had stalled over eastern Kentucky, and it was moving basically along itself, and that's called training. And that caused that heavy rainfall to fall over and over again in that same area. Whereas if it was a storm system that just moved out of the area, it would have been a lot of rain, but it wouldn't have been that same heavy rain over and over again.
For meteorologist Pete Gagarian at the National Weather Service station in Jackson, this was unusual.
Typically, our river flood season is like the peak is March, but generally December through May is kind of the typical river flood season. So to break a record in July is really, really odd.
For the mayor of Jackson, Laura Thomas, the heavy rainfall was way too familiar.
2021, the rain started at the end of February. It was, I think, the 28th that our water plant started experiencing problems because the river was rising so fast and it was affecting our intake. And then, you know, the rain kept coming and the river kept rising. And so we thought in 2021, that was going to be the highest flood we'd seen. And sadly, you know, we aren't even finished with the FEMA projects and the recovery from 2021. And then here we're hit with an even more disastrous flood in 2022.
Jeff Marietta heads the Appalachian Impact Fund.
For those of us who live here, we experienced disastrous flooding in March of 2020, March of 2021. And then, you know, this is the third. This one is on, you know, scale exponentially bigger and worse and more catastrophic than March 2020 and March 2021. But in those two floods, people lost their lives, their homes, et cetera. And so, yeah, we don't really have time. Really, we're probably going to be looking at another flood event in the spring of 23.
These extreme weather events, what is happening?
I can just tell you that the frequency and intensity is increasing. We do know that.
Jeremy Slinker, Director of Kentucky Emergency Management.
We refer to our scientist friends to help us comprehend the why and the how, and how should we be prepared for that. We definitely are concerned with the trends we have seen. So we try to take it all in. And again, we have to look at our historical data, but we are accepting the fact that the historical data may be changing in front of our eyes.
Oh, climate change is real. If you don't believe me, ask the U.S. Army or ask any farmer.
We took Governor Andy Beshear up on that and asked Jake Allgaier, a hydraulics engineer with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Louisville.
Yes, I mean, it's really a very complex question of how do we incorporate climate change into our design. But the Corps, we've developed a whole suite of tools to access data and use current global climate models to kind of inform our design about what future conditions would look like. And really a key takeaway is that future projections of climate change have a lot of uncertainty with them. And that is where a lot of the difficulty comes from. It's not usually possible to design infrastructure to a worst case, an absolute worst case future condition. You know, if we did, that would be incredibly expensive. It wouldn't be a responsible use of taxpayer money. And so it's hard to imagine designing something for that worst case condition. So we're using the best available, best actionable science that we have to try to understand the uncertainty that comes with climate change and be strategic about our designs to accommodate that. And One approach that I think makes a lot of sense is to build adaptable features into our projects, into our engineering designs, so that they can be modified in the future and not be made obsolete by future conditions, but be adaptable to them and resilient to them.
When you have creeks ballooning from 6 inches to 30 feet, that would seem to be a worst case scenario.
Yeah, that is a pretty terrible scenario. And I wouldn't call it a worst case, though. There's always
it can get worse than that.
Right.
That 2017 report I referenced says that areas south of the Ohio River are expected to see as much as 50% more precipitation and resulting in higher tributary stream flows. And it seems that that's what we saw on July 28th.
In general, climate change seems to be making the extremes more extreme. One thing we have a lot of confidence in regarding climate is that the future will be a warmer future. Air temperature is going to be warmer. And what that kind of equates to is that warmer air can carry more water. So where that water is, where it's moved from, where it's moved to, who experiences flood, who experiences drought, it's very complex to predict that. But we do have a lot of confidence in the warmer future and just the possibility of these larger, more intense storms.
We also raise the question, is climate change real, with Chris Barton, a forest hydrology professor at the University of Kentucky.
What we see looking at the data, I mean, it seems like these type of events are going to be more frequent.
We asked state climatologist Jerry Brodsky.
We've seen three of the top five warmest years during the past decade. We're also seeing a lot wetter Kentucky. And we're seeing more of a steady increase in the annual precipitation across Kentucky going back, say, over the last 100 years.
We put the question to Mark Friedlander with the Insurance Information Institute.
Climate risk is a significant issue for the insurance industry and our policyholders.
We asked Bill Henneberg, state geologist and director of the Kentucky Geological Survey.
If we continue on our current emissions trajectory and we look at the predictions going out to 2050 and 2075 and 2100, that we're going to get more rain. It's going to be hotter. We're going to have more extreme heat days. And also the really difficult thing to predict is extreme events. If you talk to climate scientists, I think one thing virtually all of us agree on is that we're going to have to expect more of these extreme events.
We hear it from Sarah Kapnick, chief scientist at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The risk of extreme events is growing, and they're affecting every corner of the world.
And from Stephanie Herring at NOAA's National Center for Environmental Information.
One of the things that has become abundantly clear is the discussion over whether climate change impacts extreme events is over. They are. And that debate is, in our minds, has been closed.
Most major scientific bodies, from NASA to the World Meteorological Organization, endorse the conclusion that the Earth is warming and that we humans and our burning of fossil fuels to keep the lights on, to heat our homes, to cook, and to drive our cars are the reason. That's an astounding level of consensus, given the contrarian, competitive nature of the scientific community. And if you have lived in Kentucky in recent decades, you know that this is a sensitive subject. From a 2011 documentary, Coal in Kentucky, produced by UK, historian and author Ron Eller.
Mountain families have great pride in their ancestry and great pride in families. For individuals who worked in a dangerous industry at little wages to provide income for their families, people are quite proud of that coal mining heritage.
If you look at, again, the world population, and you want to increase it by a third over the next 20 to 30 years, which people are expecting to do, we're going to end up using more energy.
Also from Coal in Kentucky, Joe Kraft, president and chief executive officer of Alliance Resource Partners.
There is no way that this world can function based on the amount of energy that's needed to keep people improving their standard of living, keep people growing their economies without using every form of energy we've got.
It might have been argued that in the past, most of us, the general public that is, just didn't know then what we know today. But it turns out that some were aware. It's been widely reported that Exxon's senior science advisor, James Black, reported to the oil company's management committee in 1977 that there was general scientific agreement that the most likely manner in which mankind was influencing the global climate was through carbon dioxide release from the burning of fossil fuels, yes, including coal. A year later, Dr. Black warned Exxon that, quote, present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical. This was in 1978. It's been 45 years since Dr. Black wrote that letter. According to the journal Science, additional documents show that the trade associations of the oil, gas, and coal industries had been aware since at least the 1970s. A copy of Dr. Black's report on Exxon letterhead titled The Greenhouse Effect and dated June 6, 1978 is available for review on our site weku-rise.org. You'll find it under the Resources tab. So what does ExxonMobil have to say about this? NPR's Jeff Brady.
ExxonMobil says this research is right in line with what it's heard in the past and says that the conclusion that Exxon knew about climate change and did nothing is wrong. Exxon says its understanding of climate change developed right alongside the broader scientific community. A spokesman explained in a statement that critics are looking at the company's internal policy debates and recasting them as a disinformation campaign. But the company says it's committed to being part of the solution to climate change and the risks it poses.
Today, dozens of cities, counties, and states are suing oil and gas companies for downplaying the threat of climate change, even as their own scientists warned of its dangers. Scientists at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are, in the meantime, focused on the here and now and what is driving this increase in extreme weather events. NOAA's Stephanie Herring.
The value of this work is really going to be not only in helping understand what is the future risk from an adaptation and decision-making context, but also in the impact of understanding what do our carbon emission scenarios and the implication of those really have for future extreme events.
At the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers office in Louisville, Brantley Thame serves as a national policy advisor on climate preparedness and resiliency. Kathleen Wyda, a climate change expert with the Corps, has noted that the Corps is required by law to anticipate changing conditions, and she added, this isn't something that's just in the future. Conditions are changing. If climate change is influencing more of these intense, more frequent extreme weather, I'm wondering, how is it even possible to anticipate that? The frequency factor alone must make that very difficult.
It's a very difficult problem to wrap your head around, but the Corps, and along with Dr. Kate White, when she was the COP lead for the Corps, now she works for DOD, but she started this entire community of practice and based it on translating climate science to the engineers that are going to be implementing core projects. So we're fortunate to have a lot of data at our fingertips. There's still a lot of uncertainty associated with that, but we have a really good process and guidance in place that a lot of which was put in place by Dr. White to guide us through the process that we would go through when we're doing, a planning study or something of that nature.
Are these current conditions that we're experiencing, are they changing the expectation that the future will be similar to the past? In other words, are we relying too much on deductive information versus predictive information?
I think we kind of know that the future will be different than the past. The real question is how much different and when will those differences really start to, have larger impacts? So we use a lot of deductive information, but we also, in what we do, also focus a lot on predictive information. There's global climate models out there that we utilize in the tools and the processes that we go through when we're working on a planning study to say, design infrastructure that we would use to protect against flood risk. One big part of our you know, climate assessment approach when we do a study is to not only evaluate future conditions, but also historical conditions and try and detect trends and hopefully try and attribute any increasing or decreasing trends to some sort of climate impact or maybe something else like land use development, that sort of thing.
Brantley Thames with the Corps of Engineers in Louisville. So, how to make long-term plans and devise floodplain maps when there is this degree of uncertainty about the frequency and impacts of extreme weather and its now proven ability to defy imagination? My question for Carrie Johnson, Director of the State Division of Water. Does the uncertainty around the possibility of more frequent extreme weather, climate change, make it difficult to determine with reasonable certainty what areas are likely to be flooded? Is climate change making this harder to do?
I think climate change is, while it's certainly having an impact on what we do in the flood hazard mapping world, I think it's an additional touch point, an additional data touch point that we have not only realized is occurring, but are taking steps in order to incorporate. And what I mean with that by that is, you know, what we see, especially in Kentucky, are much greater extremes. That means a lot of rain at one time like we had in July, or little rain like we had before July and then after July, right? So in seeing some of these more extremes, that actually gives us, I think, a better data set to help inform what flood hazards look like. And with the more robust modeling and mapping tools that we have available these days, we're able to take into account even those subtle changes in the climate versus just kind of blanket throwing out an assessment for a 10, 25, 50, 100, and a 500 year. With advanced modeling techniques, we can go in and depict what, you know, the flood of 2022 in July would look like, so to speak, and use that to help inform some of the more robust flood hazard modeling and subsequent mapping that we're doing.
But what if we no longer have to rely on FEMA for floodplain maps that seem to become outdated by the weather before they can be completed? Just as digital technologies have changed significantly so many aspects of life, this also goes for flood mapping.
We are about quantifying, communicating climate change risk in a way that's very usable by individuals, businesses, and government so that everybody can understand how the environment is changing, how it's going to impact them and their lives.
Ed Kearns, Chief Data Officer at First Street Foundation, a nonprofit research and technology organization.
Understanding that, you know, the current state of the art across America are FEMA's flood maps. Those flood maps, however, do not include things like heavy rainfall, nor do they include climate change. And so the obvious thing to do were to go after those additional components and bring heavy rainfall and how that's going to change in the future, and bring how climate change overall is going to be impacting flood risk through sea level rise and hurricanes and storm surge, bring all that together so we can give Americans, you know, a very clear view of how flood risk is going to be impacting their homes and their property.
What kind of data relating to climate change do you pull into this?
We go look at the rainfall rates, how heavy rainfalls are, and we understand that, you know, looking at the last 10, 20 years of weather records, we can see that the one-hour rainfalls are getting heavier and heavier over time. This is what we would expect with climate change. As the air temperatures get warmer, you can fit more water vapor into the air, and when that rain comes out all at once. So we bring that information to play. We bring in tide gauges from NOAA up and down the coast. We bring in estimates of where hurricanes are going to be moving, how storm surge will be moving around the country. And we also use the USGS stream gauges that are on rivers and creeks all around the nation as well. We bring all that information together into a type of a two-dimensional hydraulic model, and then we can actually calculate what the flood is expected to be. The flood depths are expected to be on the land surface at every property across America.
So how can this quick access to risk information, I take it you can bring it up on your phone if you're out home shopping, for example, or shopping for a business location, how can this quick access affect home prices and other things like bonds and mortgage-backed securities that are linked to real estate?
And that's still an active area of research, but one thing that we have done is we have partnered with Realtor.com and Redfin.com. And so if you are looking at real estate on those sites, you will see our environmental information from First Street Foundation, from riskfactor.com integrated into those real estate sites so that, you know, right alongside the taxes and the property location, all these other, all this other basic information about the real estate, you'll also see what the climate risk is. So again, you can make a fully informed decision about where you may want to procure a property or a property you may want to buy or sell.
I'm sure the technology, like technology does, is going to keep evolving over time, keep growing. But are these maps in an early stage of development?
These are very usable maps. We've also made this information available to a lot of government agencies as well. And so, yeah, this information is being used in business, it's being used in government, and being used at the individual level right now to make decisions. It is high quality data. We continue to improve it as new information becomes known. For example, this year we are migrating to the latest IPCC climate model data so that we're up to date and in step with the scientific community. So our idea is to always have the best and latest information available to our users at riskfactor.com.
Seems pretty disruptive for anybody who's trying to hold this information close to the vest.
We've had a lot of people ask us, should we be making this information so public, freely available? And we believe so. We believe by democratizing this information, making sure everybody has access to the same information, that nobody will be surprised. Everybody will understand what level of risk that they have. The level of risk is what it is, you know, based upon where you're living, and trying to suppress that information or not make it available to everybody else, we think puts some people at an advantage to others. And we realize that, you know, if you're a big like insurance corporation or you're a big environmental modeling firm, you have the resources to understand this already. So the average citizen that may not have those kind of resources, may not be able to have access to those kinds of maps. We want them to have access to these kinds of maps too, so that everybody understands what climate change is doing to them, doing to their property, and they can start to take steps, start to take action to reduce that risk and increase the resilience across the nation.
And that web address again?
It is riskfactor.com.
Ed Kearns with the nonprofit First Street Foundation. We'll be back in a moment.
I was thinking, well, I can't swim. That's all. I just said, Lord, if that's it, where you're going to take me, you're going to have to take me, because I ain't going to way out of here.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard documentary series on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
Rise is a special 6-week series airing weekly on Eastern Standard. Learn about what happened when record-setting flash floods hit southeastern Kentucky at the end of July. Explore what contributed to the disaster, how communities are responding, and what's needed to address the challenges ahead. Hear from those most affected and those working on solutions. WEKU's Tom Martin and a team of reporters take us on a journey as Eastern Kentucky navigates a future made less certain by climate change. To learn more about the series and listen to each episode on demand, visit weku-rise.org. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
A climate going through changes at an accelerating pace, and how that is felt and experienced on the surface of planet Earth, places like Eastern Kentucky. Jeremy Slinker, the director of the state's Division of Emergency Management.
We are concerned, and we do recognize, and this, you know, this particular flooding event, you know, made it more than evident that you can use those things that we currently have on file, such as the current floodplain maps, but you can't stake your entire response or preparedness on that. You need to look at multiple factors. And speaking with climate scientists like, you know, the National Weather Service, our partners at Division of Water, our partners at the Corps of Engineers, constantly consulting with them on what our current data is, but what could be coming, because, you know, it has been different and it has changed.
Dustin Jordan, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service station in Jackson.
When you look at just how catastrophic this event was, we had a similar event like this in 1939. You know, so we've seen something like this before in fairly recent history to kind of compare it to. That's the only thing really that I could find that compared in our, you know, in terms of a flash flood event like this, where you had a, you know, a lot of loss of life. I think that one actually was less in southeast Kentucky, more in kind of the central part of our area, and maybe a little bit further north, but still a similar, you know, event. So, you know, so we'll be looking, you know, for sure, you know, how all this is going to affect, especially with our rainfall, you know, normals going up. We just know we're getting more frequent events.
More and more, you know, we're just having these irregular climate events.
University of Kentucky hydrologist Chris Barton.
Climate is a cyclical thing, but we're experiencing these type of patterns more often. The last few years have been the wettest years we've had on record. We're seeing some unusual patterns in weather where we have these sort of micro droughts followed by flash flooding, followed by flash droughts.
And what Dr. Barton is noticing in his research is confirmed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
Put simply, extreme heat events are happening that are more extreme than we've ever observed in the observational record.
NOAA's Stephanie Herring.
We are now seeing extreme heat events that have become so severe, we're not finding close analogs in the observational record for study. And the impact of this is that these events are actually raising the need for additional research approaches in their methodology to really understand how we can ensure we're making the best risk assessments we can.
So what will be the focus of that research?
The question that this work is really focused on addressing is not this binary, did climate change have or not have an effect? It's not a yes or no answer that this field of research is trying to get at. It's the how much has the risk changed? Why has the risk changed? And what do decision makers need to know about their future risk so they can plan for some of these extremes?
This quest for understanding is playing out here in Kentucky. Alan Fryer is a professor and hydrogeologist in the University of Kentucky's Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences.
The question is, how do we judge our current climate state relative to what we know has happened in the past century or millennium or period of tens of thousands to millions of years? We know that Earth's climate has changed over time, but we also know that the effect of humans is really sort of supercharging the rate of change. And so part of understanding what is quote unquote normal depends upon understanding baseline conditions and the extent to which we might be moving out of what we've seen, at least in the historical record, if not the geologic record.
What is happening to the geology beneath our feet as a result of a changing climate above our heads?
Extreme storm events, which can be tied to climate change, in some instances at least, can be associated with not only floods, but also things like landslides. The amount of precipitation that is coming down and the rate at which it's falling is such that that has really helped to trigger what we call mass wasting, which is landslides and other instances of slope failure. And so Kentucky are also prone in some areas to landslides in the Ohio River Valley and in eastern Kentucky in particular. And as we get more intense precipitation, those storm events can be triggers for that. So that's one way in which we are affecting the planet by however much we are intensifying the water cycle.
Matt Crawford with the Kentucky Geological Survey.
We documented over 1,000 landslides with just the July flood event. Landslides that we think were triggered by that rainfall event.
What was safe last year may or may not be now.
Jeremy Slinker, the State Emergency Management Director.
I do know with the increased intensity and frequency of these events that everyone is having to make changes, accept the new normal, and figure out how to operate forward. How and what kind of changes they need to make to be able to do that, I would refer to them to make, but I know it's recognized and we're all working together to try to do that.
And if, in fact, the weather is becoming more extreme more often, what are the implications for the people of eastern Kentucky?
We all know people that we're not in the floodplain and we're flooded. So a lot of our citizens are looking, where can they go? And, of course, we want them to stay here in Kentucky, and I know we want them to stay in their home county. So we are aggressively trying to find solutions to find in those areas that they can relocate to and have a good and healthy, safe lifestyle.
This instability of the land combines with the revelation that most of the homes that were destroyed or damaged in the July flood were outside of FEMA's designated floodplains, complicating important decision-making that goes directly to the future economics of the region. Colby Hall, Executive Director of Shaping Our Appalachian Region, also known as SOAR.
We're questioning if it makes sense to invest millions in new facilities when we're not outside the floodplain. Do we even make that type of investment to rebuild knowing this could happen again?
Jimmy Owsley is a business support specialist at the Mountain Association in Berea. He works to connect small businesses and nonprofits with experts to help them grow their impact. The weather is becoming a problem.
In my work with Mountain Association, our goal is to build a new economy together. And it's this idea of making these places where folks want to live and come in. And so when this flood happens, and then there's all of this need, and there's, as you've seen, there's empty houses all over the place, there's encampments and temporary housing and buyouts, that can't help but have an effect on the local situation. And so I think one of my fellow group members said it well when she said a lot of recoveries are a 2-year effort. And this one looks like a 5-year effort. And the longer that those things take, for various reasons, the more people are going to leave. Because if you're not able to be made whole in a reasonable period of time, if you're not able to get back up on your feet again, you're going to look somewhere else. And so in a way, it seems inevitable, but I hope that we're able to kind of hold that tide back a little bit by providing opportunities for people.
As terrible as these deadly, destructive weather events are, life-altering events can present unanticipated opportunity.
You know, I think any time we're faced with adversity, we put ourselves in that frame of mind to be creative. And as devastating as it is, there can be good things that come afterward.
McKee, Kentucky native Haley McCoy, president and CEO of the Kentucky Economic Development Association, sees in this crisis a possibility that county officials in eastern Kentucky might be seeing the advantages of cooperating and collaborating across county lines.
From that economic development perspective, you know, I think regionalism is going to be one of those themes that we see come out again and again. We know as we face hardships, what good people we have in Kentucky, all across Kentucky. Western Kentucky has experienced this as well. We see the goodness of our people shine and folks reach out to serve and to help. And suddenly those county lines start to get really blurry because we just know what it means to love our neighbor. I think that within economic development, people are starting to understand that that's just the case when it comes to practice. That companies, businesses looking to locate, if you're a small business and you're trying to think about your target market, it really is less about the specific county you're in and more about where the people are, you know, who need what it is you offer. So I'm hopeful that we will see more opportunity, maybe even see more advantages, some more programs or things that, that help businesses and help communities be able to collaborate in a meaningful way to really maximize their resources.
For further perspective, we've mentioned that this is hardly the first time Eastern Kentucky has suffered from serious, deadly flooding. What happened in July of 22 was, by all accounts, the worst in living memory, and this and other recent floods seem to evidence the increasing frequency of extreme weather brought on by climate change. But it has happened in the deeper past, and from those major floods came one of the world's most remarkable feats of engineering. It had been happening over and over, heavy rainstorms causing the Leviza Fork of the Big Sandy River to rise out of its banks and gush misery and loss into the city of Pikeville, Kentucky. There was a big one in 57, then another in 77. Finally, something was done about it. We put in a call to Jason Belcher, executive director of the Big Sandy Heritage Museum in Pikeville. Pikeville literally moved a mountain to save itself from all of that flooding that I talked about, and the result was a feat of engineering, of civic foresight, and political skill on a global scale. But the origins of the Pikeville cut-through are more about coal dust than water in the first place. Is that right?
Yes. The railroads used to run right through the center of town. And back in the earliest days of Pikeville, of course, the best ways to reach it were either by water or by rail later on, the land journey being very difficult and dangerous. And so as a leftover from its earliest days, the railroad tracks did indeed bring a lot of dust and dirt and noise through downtown. And that was an item that leaders in Pikeville had long looked for a way to move, including Mayor Hambly.
And then along came all that flooding to boot, and I'm sure that that combined to move the project forward.
Exactly. So really, there were three things that had to be moved for this project to happen, and those three things were a river, a railroad, and a mountain.
Well, let's put all that in perspective. Where does it fit? When we're looking at the annals of the world's more phenomenal earth-moving operations, where does this one figure into that that configuration?
So the engineers and scientists tell us that based on the volume of material that was moved, the cut-through project is second in North American history only to the Panama Canal. And in terms of actual earth that was moved, I think the total for the Pikeville cut-through ended up being around 18 million cubic feet, which is an extraordinary amount of material to move.
And the cost in 1987 dollars, I guess it would be?
Was around $80 million, although Mayor Hambly himself admitted it could have been as high as $100, depending on how you calculate, you know, which organization did what and for how long.
You mentioned Mayor Hambly. He was a driving force behind the cut-through project. What sort of leader was Dr. William Hambly?
If you read Alice Kinder's really excellent book, The Mayor Who Moved a Mountain, she provides a really nice sketch of that. And he was the type of leader who was what we would call today a visionary or possibly a dreamer. He was someone who looked at the world and really wasn't satisfied with it the way it was. And he felt that it was his mission as a leader to change it into something better. And I think the cut-through was a clear manifestation of that.
It's hard to imagine a project of this scale moving anywhere, moving forward, without a lot of behind-the-scenes wheeling and dealing. Was Mayor Hambly skilled at that?
He was, and one of the reasons why he was so skilled at that is because he had in his mind a complete picture of what this project would look like when it was complete, and he had a visual image in his mind of how every phase of the project should go to get to that ultimate destination. And I think when he spoke to the individual representatives from all the different federal, state, and local organizations that would eventually become involved, they could clearly tell that he knew what the outcome was going to be, that he could see it, that he had measured it, it was concrete in his mind, and that really convinced them that it was something that could be accomplished.
Now, there were two others involved with Hambly to accomplish the project, Robert Holcomb and Henry Stratton. Can you tell us about them?
So Robert Holcomb was at the time the president of the National Independent Coal Operators Association, and his role he wanted to change the image of coal in eastern Kentucky, and he heard about the idea for the project, and he helped sort of elevate the publicity for it to the national level, and up from just the local level. He got it published in a story for a national magazine. Mr. Stratton was a prominent local attorney, just the kind of influential and fairly wealthy local citizen you would want on your side to try to get grassroots support amongst the people of the surrounding areas to convince them that the project not only would be beneficial, but that it could actually be done.
Now, this work went on for some time. It took 14 years to complete the cut through. And I'm just wondering, what was life like in Pikeville during those construction years?
I can actually speak to that directly because I lived just outside the city of Pikeville during the time of the cut through, although I was, this is for me, it was early childhood and elementary school. But I do remember the constant sight of the big trucks going back and forth and the delays we encountered for traffic. And, you know, for a while, for those of us that lived through it, that project sort of took on a life of its own. And we started to think that it was always going to be that way. So it was certainly, for the inhabitants and the folks from the surrounding areas, a temporary inconvenience.
Well, from the perspective of one who's been there that long, how would you say the cut-through has changed and benefited Pikeville?
The scope of change has been enormous, not only in terms of extra land area, extra usable real estate for the city of Pikeville, but it also has prevented flooding, which used to occur on a fairly regular basis. And in fact, in 1984, we had another large flood, but that one took place after the river had already been diverted. So the project wasn't 100% complete yet, but the river had been diverted and the city didn't flood. And I think that was the aha moment for almost everyone who had been a skeptic to say and acknowledge, wow, this, it actually worked. And so rather than having to start over and rebuild the downtown area every 10 years or so, which obviously impedes progress, with the diversion of the river away and the removal of the flooding, the area was able to grow and thrive. All of that growth was possible because of the changes that were brought about by this project, by the cut-through project.
Well, while this kind of infrastructure on this massive scale and expense may not be a solution to the creek and stream flooding in the more steep and narrow hollows of the counties that were hit so hard in July, still, are there lessons to be taken from the cut-through project as local and state and federal leaders think about and consider flood mitigation and community preparedness for whatever the future might hold?
Yes, I think the cut-through project is an example of how government can work. I know that's probably not a popular thing to say in our day and time, but it's an example of what can be accomplished when many different organizations, and the cut-through had them from the federal level, the state level, the local level, private contractors, when all of those work together towards a common goal and a shared vision, then the what can be achieved is substantially larger than what any of those parts could have achieved on their own. And so I think the power of collaboration, the power of coordination, and the power of a shared vision for a better future, if everyone works together, it's an example of what can be accomplished.
Jason Belcher, Executive Director of the Big Sandy Heritage Museum in Pikeville. Thank you so much, Jason.
Okay, thank you very much for the invitation.
In this episode 3 of RISE, we've heard from many experts in a variety of fields, climate scientists and meteorologists, engineers, a hydrogeologist, emergency managers, water managers, economic developers, on the matter of extreme weather, such as the rainstorm that caused the flash flood of July 28, 2022, and its connection with changes in Earth's climate. Special Projects reporter Chris Begley reflects on the value of knowledge, and why when things become perilous, having the ability to turn knowledge into action and solutions is not just a good thing, it can save lives.
Many years ago, a group of archaeology students was trying to decide how to draw a complicated map of something they had uncovered. One student started to speak, but he was not very assertive or self-assured, and another interrupted, talking over him and coming up with a solution. The confidence of this second student seemed like leadership, and the group listened to him. His idea didn't work. Finally, the quiet student spoke up again with his solution that did work, because he had experience and had learned from others who knew what they were doing. He did not meet our idea of a leader, though, and that group did not listen to him at first. In that case, it didn't cost much to make the wrong choice of who to listen to. A little time, a little extra effort. But in other circumstances, the cost can be very high. I wrote a book last year about how societies decline and collapse. I talked to a dozen scholars who studied this, and I asked them all what would be the single most important skill for us to have if things ever got that bad. They all said the same thing, every single one of them. The most critical skill for us to have would be the ability to know who to listen to, how to evaluate the information we get, and to know who would make good leaders. That overconfident student, the one who should have deferred to the person with actual knowledge and experience, was me. I learned better, eventually, to be quiet and listen and learn, but I still have to be careful, or I can mistake style for substance, or confidence for leadership, or bluster for expertise. How do we know who to trust? Who should we listen to? How do we recognize a good leader? These are important questions, and I imagine we ask ourselves this more frequently than ever before. I don't have a solution to that problem, but after listening to all the people I interviewed, I think a few basic steps can help get us closer to making the best decisions. I try to listen to what people say, not how they say it. Then look at what they do, not only what they say. Then not only what they do, but why they do what they do. We don't know what other people are thinking, but we can see possible motives for things, and that can help us assess the degree of trust we want to give that person. Is money or power involved? Some people will say or do just about anything for that. Are they attempting to divide the community into us and them? Divide and conquer is an old and easy trick, and it works to get that one person or small group what they want. It will not work for the rest of us. We are all like the students in that group, and there are plenty of loud voices vying for our attention. Some are good leaders, but many have other motives. Let's learn to recognize the real leaders among us.
That's Special Projects reporter Chris Beckley. Thanks for joining us. Rise, an Eastern Standard series, is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Jean Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Chris Begley, associate producer and special projects reporter, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. From WEKU News, Stan Ingold, Corinne Boyer, Stu Johnson, and John McGarry. Contributors to Episode 3 include the Mountain Eagles' Sam Adams, Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones, and Anya Slepian from the Daily Yonder. Rise is online at weku-rise.org, and you can contact us from the site. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for listening to Rise, a production of Eastern Standard on WEKU.